There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Mortal and Strong, the podcast, where each episode we share the interview from one of the voices from our project. Each episode we will be discussing one area of women's health from a real human who is sharing their story to help others. To learn more about the Mortal and Strong project, please visit our website, www.mortalandstrong.com. And now for today's episode.
Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Mortal and Strong. I'm Laura.
I'm Liz.
And today on the sofa, we have the lovely Amy, who is talking all about her diagnosis of breast cancer, secondary breast cancer, her family life with her beautiful daughter, and how she's dealt with all of the treatments that she's had to endure over the last few years. So welcome, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you.
Right, so we are going to crack on, as we have done with all the other interviews, with a quick fire round, because we like to get to know people.
Excellent.
And it breaks the ice a little bit. Right, so... early to bed or late?
Ooh, depends how tired I'm feeling. Depends what level of fatigue I've got on that day. I'm generally early.
Okay. Takeaway or eat out?
Eat out.
Train or aeroplane?
Ooh, good one. To be fair, the last year and a half or so has been train.
It's easier, isn't it? You can take more luggage, you can kind of,
yeah. Oh, I do. I love a good train. Definitely. And go. Like blood clots and flights don't really matter. So, you know.
We'll go on to that later. Ketchup or mayo?
Oh, that's hard as well. Oh. I kind of like both at the same time.
Like you mix
time.
Them up.
That mixes them up like a pink sauce.
Isn't that what they use in like prawn cocktails?
Pretty much, yeah.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Board games or video games?
Board games.
Call or text?
Text.
Tattoo or piercing?
Tattoo.
Holiday abroad or holiday in the UK?
Oh, abroad.
In the warmth. And boobs or breasts? What do we call them?
Boobs, actually.
Boobs.
That's a good one. That's a new one.
Fabulous. Yeah.
Well, they were Frankenboobs, and then I fell in love with them, so now they're boobs.
Frankenboobs, as in Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Love it.
That's so good. I get it. Yeah, that's good.
Sorry, I'm just that's our brains. They're not working properly. So thank you so much for coming today. Like, we really, really appreciate like everyone taking their time and telling their stories. So let's like rewind right back to sort of prior to your diagnosis and who Amy was and what she was up to and what happened and where do we go from there?
Gosh, where to really begin, to be fair. So pre the C, not the COVID C, the other C, I was training to become a lawyer, finally, after many years of not really wanting to do that. I was doing exams and everything. I actually had an exam scheduled for the day of my first chemotherapy, so that was cancelled, and yeah. I never went back to it, sadly. But so I was working full-time, mumming full-time around that, trying to be the best version of me that I could be.
How old was your little one at this point?
She was four.
Okay.
Yeah.
How old are you?
33.
So we're going back 3 years ago?
Yeah, so I just turned 33. So it's 4 years ago in August that I then got the diagnosis of breast cancer, which changed the course of my life completely.
It just sends you off on a new path, doesn't it? So what took you to go and get checked out?
I found a lump. And I was always pretty hot on checking. My mum had breast cancer when she was 40. So obviously having the history and the young history as well, I was always quite good at making sure that I checked.
And that's it. So it helps, doesn't it? Because you've already got someone you know about it later.
And it's just so important to know you're normal because your boobs and stuff change every single month with hormone changes and things. And, you know, it's really important to know you're normal. And I was good at checking, but I probably didn't check them as often as I should have done. It wasn't
Were you checking when you found the lamp, or was it just by accident?
No, I was in the shower, which is when I generally checked for anything, and I felt this sort of lamp, and I was like, that doesn't feel quite like normal.
What did it feel like, just for people who've not got
it? Was weird. It was, so the first bit that I felt, it just felt like a sort of like a knotty lump of tissue, but it didn't feel just like the glandular tissue that you sometimes get. It felt a bit more solid than that.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a bit weird, but it wasn't like a well-defined lump as such. Like when my mum had breast cancer, it felt like she had literally like a bullet in her breast. But for me,
and you're young, like you're in your early 30s, you'd just been a mum of a 4-year-old. Did you get taken seriously when you went to the GP?
I did, actually. I was very fortunate. I think also because it was COVID, it was over the phone, and I was a bit like, oh, they're just going to dismiss me. But
and you're saying about your mum.
But as soon as I said, you know, my mum had breast cancer, and the doctor that I spoke to was like, look, I could get you in and have a feel. She was like, but I don't know what it's going to be, so I'm just going to refer you straight away.
That's really
which
good.
Was amazing. Wow. Yeah, so she did, and there was the longest 2.5 week wait. Yeah,
I know that feeling. And it's just I think you don't want to believe it could be.
No.
I think it's that weird.
No. But I knew it was.
I knew straight away that it was, and that like later on when I then got myself dressed, I noticed I had like a dimple underneath, and
so there was more than one sign.
And within that 2.5 weeks, I then had lymph nodes pop up in my armpit, and I had another lump appear, and I was just like, I'm gonna die.
Oh,
this is ridiculous. I mean, obviously your anxiety is like way up here anyway.
Yeah. And did you tell people?
Only my immediate kind of family and stuff, but I didn't tell anyone, and my boss.
Because you have to time off.
So you went in and had the full work. They did like their one stop shop, I think they call it, in the breast centre. I went in, I had an ultrasound, and then I had another mammogram, and then they sent me back for another ultrasound,
and then they sent me back for another mammogram.
It's when they do it more than once, you start to go,
and they went and put the clips in, and then they wanted to do a mammogram with contrast because they weren't sure what was going on the other breast because there was a bit of a anomaly coming up on that side as well, but they couldn't cannulate me, so I didn't have the.
So you already had bad veins before you went.
I had dreadful veins. That's the rain.
Right. So you've had your diagnosis, or you've had your one stop shop. You go home. You have. Did they tell you then they think it was cancer?
Yeah. So because they score it, don't they? I think it's up to 5, and 5 is definitely cancer.
Right.
But they couldn't give me the 5 because obviously they needed to biopsy it. But they gave me a 4, and she sort of did the whole.
She'd already prepped you.
They did the whole head on the side, like, it's cancer, but we can't say it's cancer until we.
So then you go back
a week later,
and then you got your definite it's cancer, and then got told your regime, or did they not know at that point?
So I then had to go through. I had to have a breast MRI scan because they couldn't do the contrast and all that kind of stuff. I had to have a nuclear bone scan. I think the concern at that point was because they were so sure that lymph nodes were impacted, obviously then it can spread,
so they're very much
so
like,
I had to have that first, and then so that was August, and then my first chemo wasn't until the 22nd of September, so it was about a month then between having all the
and that waits so hard, isn't it? It's like a really like difficult period because you know you've got to have the treatment, you know this cancer is growing in you,
and with how quickly it changed, I was just like, oh my goodness, this is really when you can feel and you can see, and it's obvious that there are changes going on.
What
was your staging initially when you first?
I was grade 3, stage 3, because it had already travelled to the lymph nodes, and so it was still treated as a primary cancer.
Yeah.
But because of the aggressiveness, I've got HER2 positive cancer and hormone fed cancer, both
progesterone.
It's good for treatment options, but it's not good for the spreading and the aggressiveness of it. Yeah.
People listening who don't know what HER2 is and the genetic side of it, could either of you?
Yeah, so I mean, I was completely oblivious to the world of breast cancer. I mean, my mum had it, she was hormone positive, I knew about that.
Yeah, but I didn't realise just
how many different nuances between breast cancers there were. I mean, even if on paper you look like you should have the same one, it's completely different.
And they work differently too.
But you've got different subtypes, you've got ductal, so where it grows in your milk ducts, and then you've got the other, it can just be anywhere.
So with the estrogen one, it's obviously fed by your womanly hormones, which means you know, we have to be very careful about not putting any estrogen back into our body, and they sort of strip it a lot of the time. HER2 is human
epidermal regrowth hormone.
So it's another thing, but it sort of was explained to me like it was a ball with lots of spikes on it, and all the spikes kind of grab the HER2 onto it.
Yeah, they've got different receptors.
And yes, they have to use something to sort of block that. It's very complicated, even like living with it, it's really hard to kind of explain it because it's not, you know, it's not really ever explained that well to us. You just know that actually, if you've got the HER2, it's generally quite aggressive and quick growing. But we are fortunate that there are more treatments.
There are. I mean, 15 years ago, it was essentially a death sentence if you had HER2 positive.
Yeah, so we're lucky to have it now.
Definitely. Very much so.
And then, so they're straight into chemo?
Straight into chemo. I also had genetic testing at this point because being the age that I was, being triple positive, having had a person in my family, you know, with young breast cancer as well. And they just changed the criteria for some of them. So rather than just a BRCA testing, which my mum had already had and was negative for. So, you know, at no point did I actually ever think I was going to get breast cancer because, you know, everybody thinks it's BRCA, it's all BRCA, that's all it is. But there's so many others. So they also checked me for PAL check 2 and TP53. Mm-hmm. And they said to me at the time, they were like, put the paperwork for TP53 to the side because it's super rare. There's like
no family. There's like seven families in the whole country that have got it. You know, it's not going to be that.
Wow. So you just kind of put it to the side. And then a week before surgery, they called. They're like, oh, you've got TP53. Oh, okay.
Right.
So the one that nobody expected anybody to have. And, you know.
Did you find that helpful? Because it kind of gave you an answer to why you got it.
Yes,
in a way it was helpful because I think you get a cancer diagnosis, you sit there and you go, did I drink too much?
Yeah. Did I do something wrong in my
diet? Have I put too much stress on my body? You know, what have I done to cause this? Because you're sort of thrown into this world of turmoil, I think, you know, where you question everything. So having an answer was great, but then knowing that I'd already had a child and that there was a 50% chance that she would have that gene as well, it felt like having another diagnosis almost, and then this, you know, heavy weight on your shoulders of, what have I done?
what would you say, like, how would you describe that feeling of being diagnosed at the time?
With the gene mutation or with cancer?
With just cancer, the whole thing, with knowing that you've got cancer.
You've gone from training to be...
To be honest, I think because I knew, in my heart of hearts, I knew it was going to be bad news. So everybody around you is saying, it'll be fine, it's just going to be a dodgy, you know, lump. And
so you'd sort of prepared yourself
I'd already prepared myself. Okay.
Did you half expect, because of your mum and the fact that you were checking regularly, in the back of your mind, were you almost expecting it, or did it totally blindside you?
It totally blindsided me, to be fair. I mean, yeah, the checks were there. But as I said, because she'd been tested for the traditional breast cancer genes, I'd relaxed. So, you know, I checked myself because it was what you should do kind of thing, not because there was any expectation that I would.
And if it was going to happen, you probably didn't think it would happen until you're maybe in your 40s or 50s.
No, and then also, you know, because I did check regularly, even though it wasn't every month, you know, it was still regularly, I kind of always thought it would always be caught at an early stage, but what I hadn't anticipated was just the aggressiveness with which it was growing and things. So my first lot of chemo, I had 4 lots of chemo, and then I had surgery where I had the Dieppe reconstruction at the
you
same
had it
time.
Removed at the same both or one
yeah both so yes. I had double mastectomy. The Dieppe reconstruction is where they take tissue from your abdomen to reform your boobs. So I had that all done at the same time, which was really
and how
lucky.
Many people told you you're getting a boob job and a tummy tuck?
Everybody. Yeah,
honestly,
you should be really grateful. Yeah, great.
We've tried to kill me, and I've got a free tummy tuck out of it. Not right.
When I had my removed, I'd kind of because I had the chemo and then the mastectomy, I almost felt like I was ready to have my boots off, because they were like, it was that you'd kind of I'd become quite
associated
and angry at them.
Yeah, I was ready as well, definitely. But I knew I was going to have to have more chemo afterwards as well. So it was, I just kind of staged everything. So, you know, phase one was the first sort of chemo, and then phase two was the surgery.
You have to look at
phase three was the next sort of chemo, and phase four was the radiotherapy. And then it was like, woo, out into the world of non-cancerness. I mean, cancer stays with you forever, even if it doesn't then.
How did you cope emotionally during those stages?
I think it's just holding on to the end of those points, because it's taking you nearer to where you then expect to be.
And you sort of feel that there's a finish line, isn't it? It's like, you get to that end goal and you know, like, oh, I'm going to be better.
Exactly.
What people don't tell you is that actually the
anxiety and everything stays completely. I mean, I never reached the end of my treatment before they then decided that I had secondary.
Oh, really? So where was that found?
So that was found in my spine and my femur to begin with.
But how did you...
So on my third round of my last lot of chemo, I ended up in hospital with appendicitis, because I just had all, it just caused so much inflammation everywhere. So it wasn't like a infection-based appendicitis, it was just inflammation from one of the drugs that I was taking. And when they did one of the CT scans, they picked up something on my spine.
Had they done a CT?
They had done a CT scan beforehand. So before, and it's, wow. We'll come to that. So off I went for this MRI scan while I was still an inpatient, and they came back and they're like, oh, it's just a hemangioma, which is like a little collection of blood vessels, and, you know, nothing to worry about, no problem. And then 2 weeks after that, I then went for my radiotherapy planning scan. So they have to scan you to make sure that they're zapping the right bit, essentially, with the radiation. And then I was driving actually for a completely unrelated hospital appointment, and my oncologist called and he was like, you've got these hot spots and we're changing your treatment. And I was like, what hot spots? You know, had literally no idea what was going on driving on the A47.
What's going on?
Like, talk to me in English. I don't know what that means.
And he was like, it's fine, you know, you've had these hot spots on your leg and blah blah blah. And I'm sitting there thinking, no, I haven't. What are you talking to the right people? You know, what's going on? So I kind of hung up the phone and went off and had my appointment, and then kind of sat at home and I was like, I mean, I've got secondary. Like, has he just told me I've got secondary cancer? Like,
but to say that over the phone. At least, like, ask if someone's with you. I mean, you could...
And I actually said to him, I was like, I'm driving in my car right now, you know, when he called. When they say, are you sitting down?
Yeah.
You need to, but you're not driving.
Because he didn't specifically say what hotspots meant, I didn't really kind of grasp what was being said. So
although I knew what it was, I
kind of didn't until the next day when I then called the breast care nurse. I was like, what does this mean?
But also, why didn't they bring you in to like have a chat?
Yeah, he did get into trouble.
I mean, that's not the best way to deliver the news.
So I then spoke to the breast care nurse and she was like, yeah, so you've had these hot spots since the beginning. And I was like,
whoa,
hang on a second. I was like, I've got my bone scan and my CT scan, and it says, you know, no evidence of disease anywhere. And she was like, yeah, there were these. So basically, when they did the planning scans and it brought up this thing in my spine, they then did like a quality control, I suppose, of all my previous scans. And because obviously they knew where they were looking, they could see that I actually had these metastases right from the start.
So how many months? This is like, what, 6 months since you got diagnosed?
So that was April. So about 6 months. So I was...
Would it have changed? I could see the light at the end of the treatment.
And then it's bam, like, blackout. Yeah.
I've got this for life. And
I'm obviously been through a secondary diagnosis. How, at that point, did you feel?
Like devastated. Devastated, because I think at that point, I mean, I'd educated myself a little bit more on, you know, what would happen if it became secondary.
But you don't expect it to happen that soon.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. And I think they don't, all the information I got was from support groups on Facebook and things. It wasn't anything that a doctor or a clinician had said to me. And I think there's a fine balance between sort of sending women off on their way with, woohoo, you're cured. But actually telling them the reality that 30% of people will go on to develop secondaries, which is a lot.
And don't get the information about secondaries. At that point, you kind of get told, oh, just watch out for a bit of pain or a bit of this, but you don't.
And you get the screenings that they only screen your breasts, and it's like, well, actually, you know, they weren't going to do any further screenings on my boobs.
Thank goodness.
But at the same time, you know, if it comes back, it's more likely to come back somewhere completely different to your breast. So a mammogram isn't going to hide it.
And did you find that you had pain, like a back pain or anything?
I did, but I'd had a car accident like about 10 years before that. And, you know, I've always had lumbar pain and I worked an office job. I was sitting down a lot. You know, it was kind of everything I could excuse, I suppose, as being that. But yeah,
and it's just been reassured that you didn't have secondaries.
Exactly, literally, so it wasn't even on the radar.
especially not driving my car on my way to a different appointment. So yeah.
How did you tell your daughter?
I haven't fully told her.
Okay.
I think she is just a little bit too young to properly understand what it is. We've been really open and honest with her. She knows that I've got cancer. Mm-hmm. She knows that I still have medicine to keep it under control. But we haven't gone so far as saying it's incurable and mummy will die of it, because it's just a bit too much for her to kind of deal with, I think. You know, she knows that I'm ill. She deals pretty well with it, to be fair. But I think it's because right from the start, we used the right words and we said what was going to happen. And I didn't want it to become like the Voldemort word, you know, that thing that can't be spoken about. So, yeah, she's pretty good.
How are you coping? Are you open in front of her when you're feeling bad and you're having a bad day, or do you try to hide it from her?
No. I think to begin with, I probably tried to hide it a little bit, but as you know, with your own things that you've got going on, especially like the physical things, like the fatigue and the brain fog, and you know, sometimes I hit this brick wall and I physically cannot do anything else.
Yeah.
And you can't hide that, and you can't lie your way out of that.
But as you say, you can still say, well, I'm ill and I've got a problem, but you haven't gone.
Mummy just needs to have a little rest now, and you know, I'll come and play with you again in an hour, kind of thing.
The kids are not daft, and if they saw that you were hiding something, they pick up on
a lot.
I had some really good advice that I was told, that kids are not daft, and if you're honest with them, you're actually teaching them, showing them how to navigate it, and that the whole point of what we're doing is it's okay to be unwell.
Yeah,
you still do stuff, you still function.
It is.
They need to learn from you how to keep going and what you do when you're not feeling well.
Yeah, it's important. I think it's important for her to see when I'm feeling sad as well, because you know, again, it's teaching them how to navigate things. And part of me feels really guilty, because I feel like she's had to grow up quite a lot. I mean, she's 8 now, and you know, since she was 4, cancer has been in her world, so half of her life has been dominated by cancer. And it's not just me, my mum has also got cancer, and you know, her and my mum are like best buddies, so that's particularly hard to kind of navigate, especially like my mum's now also got secondaries, but it's not looking that great. And I think at that point, cancer will then become something that can kill you, and
that's when she might learn
that's going to be much harder to navigate with Sophia. So yeah, we're sort of trying to set down the right foundations without scaring her at the moment, if that makes sense. But it's really tricky when.
And it just adds another layer of complexity. It's not just the physical symptoms and the medical appointments.
Yeah.
It's the emotional.
It's the disruption to your life.
Absolutely. And it's hard enough being a mum without having like illness attached to it as well, you know.
How have you found, like, obviously you got married since having your cancer diagnosis, I know that, but how have you found that he has taken the role? Because I've seen that, you know, they have to step up a bit more in terms of parenting and just being there for you. It's
definitely hard, and it's definitely a strain, I think, on the relationship. I think anything like this, and you know, we definitely have our ups and we definitely have our downs, but I think that's normal in any kind of relationship. I do think that illness kind of highlights it and makes it that little bit worse sometimes.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's hard on everybody.
You know, obviously the focus is on the person that is ill, but it has a ripple effect to everybody that's within your family. And
there's no support or real acknowledgement of the partner, of the spouse.
No.
So, you know, you go to the appointments and everyone's looking at you.
Yeah.
The nurses are asking how you are. And they're almost this shadow.
Shadow that's next to you, yeah.
It's got to keep it together.
There's no one for them.
I think being diagnosed in COVID, like everything I was on my own for anyway, so you know, in that respect I'm kind of used to that bit.
And it's hard because I don't know if you've found, but you hear of couples going through something traumatic in life, and you assume it's going to bring you closer together because you're fighting it together.
Yeah.
But what actually happens is everyone responds to completely differently, and it changes who you are.
It does.
It changes your personality.
It does.
And you then have to try and navigate a new relationship that wasn't a relationship.
Especially when you're younger as well, is that you don't expect to be in that position with your spouse from a young age. You know, expect to get married and, like, you know, have your family and do everything, enjoy your nice holidays and enjoy life, not be a carer and not be kind of helping, you know. And also it's that loss thing.
There is a lot of loss and a lot of grief to kind of deal with in that. And I think, you know, being hormone positive, they've shut down my ovaries. So, you know, that
all sorts of problems.
Not only am I dealing with the menopause that is so much worse because you can't actually take anything to help with it. You know, there's literally nothing you can
and
do with
down
it.
Down, and then, you know, you want to fulfill your wifely duties. But actually, it's a bit like,
that's the last thing that's on my mind.
And that's hard. Like, that's really hard. You need to take a moment to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
When you go through menopause, that is the last thing, regardless of the fact that you've got your medical problems, you're in pain, you're stressed, you're dealing with all the other stuff. It's not working the same.
It's when you read. I remember.
To sleep, it's shut down. Yeah.
I remember reading many a magazine when I was younger, being like, "Your 30s as a woman is your prime. You know, you're going to be this like sexual god."
Just like,
no. Like, oh damn, that's, you know, that was fun when it lasted.
Yeah, it's that balance of fulfilling your wifey duties versus feeling, well, shouldn't have to fulfill, but it's a big part of a relationship.
It is a huge part, especially like you say, when you're younger, you know, obviously when the menopause kind of normally happens, you're a bit older, and like you say, you've had your family, and
you're maybe not into
those years are kind of past you.
Yeah,
and it can be really difficult, and I think very, very difficult to kind of explain that to your partner.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, I've had surgery, so my body's covered in scars. I don't feel as in love with it as what I did before.
Yeah.
You know, my boobs are not real boobs anymore.
So you've got no boobs, no libido, no. You know, scars everywhere.
Exactly.
Tired.
Exactly.
It's a recipe for complete disaster. Yeah. And you don't have the same feeling because obviously it's not tissue that should be there. And there's a lot of stuff that's going on that, just.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
On the outside, I look normal and nobody would know what I've got going on. But on the inside, there's a lot that's happening in there and it's all churning up all the time. And
so let's go back to your diagnosis. So you then had your secondary one. Treatment-wise, how did you get on? Did you have to change your treatment from your initial?
Yeah, so I started on my first line of treatment, which seemed to work to begin with, but only worked for 9 months, and then I was on a second lot of treatment.
And that's the thing people, again, don't necessarily understand, is that treatments don't necessarily, your body overcomes it.
And I think also because I'd seen so many positive stories of people with my kind of cancer lasting for years and years on this first line of treatment, you know, the disappointment when it then 9 months later had completely stopped working, and all of a sudden, you know, I had this 3 millimeter spot on my spine that then became my entire lumbar spine that had been engulfed with cancer. And then, you know, again, I had a small spot on my femur that then was, you know, 10 mil and another spot around it.
And
it's continuous. And
it's almost like having a new diagnosis, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's that constant being like, you know, I'm going, and then you hit back down again.
Exactly. And you sort of get to that point where you're like, okay, I'm not feeling so anxious about it now. And as soon as you let your guard down, it's like, boom, right, now you've got something else, you know. So I had some radiotherapy to those areas, and that was fine. But I did end up in hospital again because my body was a bit like, not sure I like that radiotherapy that you just did to me.
Yeah, talk to us about the most recent issues, because you've been in hospital a lot recently.
I have. So, I mean, that kind of was, so that's that 2022. Yeah, that was quite hardcore. And then I had a year of feeling pretty good. You know, everything was okay. I'd spent a little bit of time recovering, and obviously I had quite a lot of inflammation, and my mobility wasn't great. And
just to clarify for people who aren't familiar with breast cancer journey, what is it that you're continuously taking? Or are you taking anything?
Yeah, so I have treatment at bay. So I have an IV treatment every 3 weeks, which is a new kind of drug that has like a chemotherapy attached to an antibody. The antibody kind of attaches to the cell and then...
It's targeted therapy, isn't it? Yeah.
So it's a bit more targeted than when you have proper chemotherapy, which just attacks everything that's mm-hmm. in its sight. So it's not quite as hardcore on the side effects. But this one is a lot harder than the other two treatments I've been on. I could have a fairly normal life with those, whereas this one, I'm quite sick quite a lot. And
you're feeling like you're having treatment.
Yeah, it's not as simple as, right, I'm in hospital that day and then I can forget about it for the next 3 weeks. Yeah. It's how long am I going to have before I feel good, before I have the next treatment kind of thing. I also have my ovary shut down every month as well. So because I'm on this conjugated drug combination thing, they stopped my hormone tablets I was taking, which I was grateful for, because that made me feel like I was walking on broken ankles every day.
So, oh yeah, I know that feeling. You get out of bed, you're like,
you go from 33 to 93 and it's just like, what's going on? Oh, you know?
And it's so good that people all have that in the same, because I'm like, why am I so stiff and
it's awful, isn't it? Yeah. I did find though that switching up the brands of that particular drug helped. So there were some which literally I couldn't walk without feeling like I was on broken glass. Wow. And then others, I had a bit of stiffness, but you know, once you've kind of stretched and moved things around, I could function like a normal person.
So
I did this very unscientific experiment on one of the Facebook groups. I was like, ladies, you know, which brand are you taking? And are you noticing things? I did like a little spreadsheet and figured out which ones I wanted. And then I went to my pharmacy. I was like,
these are the ones I want, and these are the ones you're going to get me, because
cancer's sneaky.
When you think
you're ahead of it, that's when it comes and takes you by surprise. So last year I had what I thought was a blood clot in my leg. And again, I think especially when it's secondary cancer, because, you know, you're going to die anyway, is sometimes the feeling that you get from people. It was like, yeah, you've got a blood clot here, have some anticoagulants. Mm. There's no follow-up done or anything. And I sort of think, you know, if I was 35, and I didn't have cancer and I had a DVT in my leg, they would be checking to make sure it was going away. So, you know, every 3 months I have my normal CT scan, and it just kept saying, yes, the blood clot's still there. And, you know, there were numerous times where I was being switched to different anticoagulants because they were calling it a failure of treatment and things like that. But what actually was happening was I had a new tumour growing in my leg. So, back to the TP53 gene mutation.
So it's not linked to the breast cancer, or it is linked to the breast cancer?
It's a completely separate cancer.
But within the gene.
But it's basically, the TP53 gene, basically you can get any kind of cancer.
Right. There's
so
more heightened to get
generally it, you can get it wherever they do. If it wasn't for having secondary breast cancer, I'd be having yearly full body MRIs and brain scans and all sorts.
Right, okay.
But they didn't want to complicate things because I already had breast cancer. So, you know, they didn't.
They'd done away with things.
They just assumed that you weren't going to get another one.
Yeah, exactly. So. But also what it does, it makes you more sensitive to radiotherapy. So they believe, although they can't be 100% sure, that this sarcoma that I had growing in my femoral vein was a direct result of having the radiotherapy to my hip and my femur where I had the cancer. So, sarcomas are pretty common for people with TP53. They're very rare generally. So that was their theory. So by the time they got to it in November, it was 13 centimetres.
Wow.
So it was a good
thing.
And
you spent a month
at the Marsden, which was lovely.
You grow them fast.
I do. I mean, I had a biopsy done about 16, 17 days before I had the surgery done, and it was grade 2. And by the time they excised it and they did the pathology and stuff, it was already grade 3. So
it grew in like a week?
Not just grown, but it had become more aggressive. Okay. So, you know, I'm now worrying about whether I've got sarcoma growing around in my body as well as the breast cancer.
I think any pain, any problem, you're just like, what?
Yeah.
Again, it's that bad news.
Exactly, it is continuous.
You get into a cycle of waiting for the next bad news.
You do.
It's become your new normal.
You do. You really
do. And you just never know. It's the... I remember we were speaking about it around Christmas in our secondary group. But, you know, you put your Christmas tree away and you don't know if you're getting it back up again, because it is that constant living on this knife edge of it can change at any moment. Yeah. And when that changes, you don't know what's next.
You really don't. And I think, you know, you've experienced it as well. You know, we've got this amazing community of people who all totally get it. But sadly, the nature of this disease is that you then lose those people as well. And having seen lots of people who, you know, seem fit and well 1 minute and then are gone the next, you kind of realise actually how fragile life is, I suppose, as well. And
for me, it's kind of sometimes a good thing, because it reminds me actually this is, because sometimes you can get complacent, can't you, and be like, oh, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
And when it happens, it almost reminds you that this disease is deadly. It does kill people, and it does, especially young people. It seems to sort of happen very, very fast. So it almost reminds me to live and to be grateful of the time I have, because you just don't know when it's going to be taken away from you.
No, definitely. I mean, it does eventually. There is that moment of time where you're like, oh, it's going to be me.
Do you allow yourself to go down that rabbit hole?
I think you have to. It's impossible to not. And actually, it's really hard to stay positive all the time. And it's, you know, we spoke about masks and things earlier on, and I think having that mask up all the time is really hard. And
it's draining.
It is, which is why I think actually having the community that we have is so important, because, you know, my mum and dad don't want to hear my morbid thoughts. So if I have those thoughts, at least I've got people I can talk to.
You have great dark humour, don't we?
We do. I mean, the dark humour is insane.
I mean, from anyone who doesn't know, that is Secondary Sisters, which actually we branched out into the Norfolk Secondary Sisters, which Amy became one of the first little members of the group. So she's an original, which is great. But it's like having that incredible community where we can talk about anything, and that can be, you know, oh, what funeral songs do you want, or, you know, what's your plan for writing your will, or, you know, what do you think about this? And I think it is so important you can have those conversations without it being taboo.
That's the thing. And you know, like before I went in for my surgery, I made sure I had all my funeral plans written out and things, and my husband was like, what are you doing that for? And I was like, but, you know, if anything happens, that's one less thing that you need to worry about. And I think it's so important that we talk about the fact that we are mortal, like, you know,
the
only guarantees in life is that you're going to get taxed out of your money and you're going to die at the end of it.
You know, and you can't take your money with you.
And you can't take it with you. So, you know, perhaps it's because I'm in the situation where I'm facing it that I'm a bit more open about it. But I just, I genuinely feel like it shouldn't be
I had this conversation with my husband, and I was like, well, I haven't written my full funeral plan, but I've got kind of notes and stuff of what I'd like. And I sort of said to him, well, you sit down and write yours, because what happens if I wouldn't necessarily know what you would want. And it is that, it's like, why?
It's almost a kindness, isn't it? Yeah. Because they're going to be grieving your lot, or the lot of you. So, you know, the last thing they're going to want to do is think, what hymn does she want to pick? Or, you know, does she want a religious service?
But you also feel that it gives you that peace of mind, because you know it's done.
Yeah.
And also, sometimes facing your fear takes away some of the anxiety. It does. Some people don't want to go there because they can't consider the fact that they will die. But it's going to happen to all of us.
Exactly.
If we live with this fear of there's an elephant in the room and I'm not going to address it, whether you've got a condition or not, by avoiding the fact that we are all going to die, it's creating this anxiety and you're fueling that Voldemort fear of that word.
Yeah, and it's that it gives you that purpose and gives you that sense of like, right, I may not be here, so let's live. I'm not saving for the fact that
it's you taking control of it, isn't it? Because I feel like in my biggest loss and my biggest sort of grief point, I suppose, is the loss of my future and the loss of the control that I had on it.
And being there, I suppose, for your daughter
as well.
You know, you feel that's that responsibility.
But being able to take back the responsibility of the things that I can control, it gives me a bit more of my sense of purpose again. You know, I'm not just cancer. I am still Amy. I am still mummy. I am still
a person.
You know,
not just a cancer patient.
Because I do, you know, I think we do end up being just cancer patients, don't we?
There's so much more to all of us.
There is.
We've got our own stories and, you know, our own hobbies and everything. There's so much more. And it is that hard. I remember losing my career. You know, I remember losing my fertility. And I was then labelled Laura with incurable cancer.
Yeah.
And it's like, but I was a hairdresser and I, you know, I'm a fur mummy and it's all these other things that you do, but people do just go, she's Laura with cancer. And it's that real horrible identity.
Yeah.
You know, you've lost your purpose in life. You've lost that identity. You've lost everything. But like you say, finding the things you can control rather than dwelling on the things that
you can't.
You know, you can't control the fact your medication might stop working. You can't control the fact that you may not be here next year.
No.
What you can control is how you feel today.
You know, I do allow myself to have my down days, but I do just have to pick myself up and dust myself off and carry on going. I think having a daughter obviously helps because, you know, I look at her and she's something to push and to live for.
Do you feel your self-identity has changed?
Completely. I mean, I'd literally just, so when I had Sophia, I had quite bad postnatal depression and going back to work helped me find my way again. And, you know, I did a law degree at uni and hated it. It wasn't like Ally McBeal, which I think was the issue. And I ended up working in hospitality for years. And I just sort of started to get a bit settled when I then had Sophia. And again, it's that loss of identity. You sort of stop being Amy and you become mummy. And
it's a massive change.
It's a huge change. And then, you know, I then started working in this law firm and I was like, oh my goodness, you know, why haven't I done this for the last 10 years kind of thing?
So you did enjoy it.
I then enjoyed it. And then I started off as just someone who did the photocopying. And
is that because it gave you a bit of you back?
It did. It was me. I was Amy again. And it was exactly, you know, and I was there and I was good at what I did. And
as our conversations.
Praise you. And, you know, I felt like I was achieving something.
Yeah.
And then cancer comes and then you're back to where I was when I was Amy with P&D.
You carried on working for a bit or you stopped working?
I did. So I stopped working through my primary treatment and then I went back to work part time. But I stopped after the whole radiotherapy hospital thing.
It's hard.
I've tried to go back, but just the fatigue and especially now with this new drug that I'm on with the nausea and
triggers. We all have that, we almost just use that spoon theory, don't we? And it's like if you use up all your spoons on your job, then you've got no spoons to
do the fun stuff with your children and with your family. And yeah, that is what it is.
You know. This is the spoon theory for anyone who's
doesn't know what we're talking about.
Spoon theory is this theory that you've only got so many spoons of energy per day, and for most people they have 3 or 5 spoons of energy. But if you've got a chronic illness, you might be already on less spoons than somebody else. And if you use all your spoons in that day, for some people, washing their hair, we were saying this, just washing your hair might use all 3 spoons.
Yeah.
And you already are negative, and if you do too much, you've borrowed from tomorrow's spoons, and
you're starting on an extra negative.
And then
you just crash. Burnout, crash.
It's a vicious cycle, isn't it? Mm. But you know, I do still try and do things. You know, especially for my little one, I don't want her memories of me to be mummy being poorly. So like last year, we went interrailing through Europe, and I took her up the Eiffel Tower, and you know, I do try and do lots of fun things with her because.
It's making memories.
I want her to look back on her time and be like, you know what, mummy was ill, but we still had an amazing time.
They will be the most precious things.
The pressure of fulfilling your duties as a female, you know, we still live in a patriarchal world ultimately, don't we? And it's really hard then when you throw chronic illness into the mix, I think.
So if you're not working, what is it that you're doing at the minute to rehold?
Amy. Where's Amy?
Most of my life is spent remembering what clubs and after school things Sophia has got.
So you become taxi driver, her chauffeur.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, to be honest, as I said, this latest treatment is quite debilitating. So I spend more time than I would probably like to not doing very much. Or just about getting by the stuff that I need.
But it's important to
them.
Realise that you have to allow yourself that. And it might be that it gets easier over time, but like you know.
I do have my routine and, you know, I've got a dog as well, so I make sure that I take him out for walks and things all the time. And
fair babies.
We
always
do
good.
A lot. I've kind of become quite involved with my local church as well. Like faith for me was something that was always a little bit on the peripheral.
But it's kind of come a bit more into the forefront with my diagnosis. I think it can send you one of two ways. It can either bring you closer to faith, or it can make you go, well, what's going on here? You know,
no God would allow this kind of thing.
But it's what's right for you. And I think that's what's really important.
I take quite a lot of comfort from just sort of praying and that sort of meditative state and things. It kind of pulls me out when I'm feeling a bit too blue.
What would you say to someone who is newly diagnosed and in a similar position, maybe being young, maybe a mum, you know, is there any advice that you would have given yourself?
I'd probably say don't panic. Like the first thing that you do when you're faced with such a horrible diagnosis is just catastrophize, and you just think of the worst of what's going to happen, and it's not worth it. You know, don't waste that time thinking about that kind of thing. What happens will happen, and there are so many innovations and new drugs out there and new treatments and things that actually I read an article recently about it, and they are treating secondary cancers more as a chronic illness as opposed to a terminal illness, because people are living for longer with them,
which is amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, it doesn't get rid of the fear. No. It doesn't stop the reality that, you know, at some point the treatments are going to stop working. There is nothing better in this world than hope, and you need to hold on to that. I think that's where my faith kind of came in, because for me, faith is hope and hope is faith. So
it all
kind of links together. But yeah, without having hope, and it's not the death sentence that it used to be. It's, you know, 15 years ago, it was such a different world. I mean, technically, I'm coming up to my fourth year in August. And whilst that makes me feel a little bit scared because of the average life expectancy of people with breast cancer, it also makes me feel really proud, because I am still here and I am living well with cancer. You know, yes, it's there and there are times when it takes over, but touch wood, as yet, it hasn't completely taken over. So
I have one final question, and it's, what makes you smile in the mornings as you get up? What's the one thing that gets you out of bed and makes you smile?
Probably my little girl, to be fair. She is the one that gets me out of bed.
I'm not surprised. She's probably like, Mummy!
Otherwise, I'd be laying in bed having another nice time. No, she is my absolute world.
Didn't you say she woke you up this morning?
She did.
Mummy, you need to do hair and makeup. Get up.
So she's your alarm clock. That's brilliant.
Yeah, perfect. She's got normally. And she was brilliant this morning because she went in, she made her own breakfast. I walked into the kitchen and her lunchbox was on the side, and I opened it up and she's like, I've already made my lunch for today. And I was like, wow, this is amazing.
She's so adorable.
Yeah, she is really helpful. And like the other morning, I walked her to school, and it's only recently that I've been able to sort of properly do that. And she gave me a hug when we got to school, and she went, Mummy, you're doing such a good job with your walking right now. Oh. And it was just the sweetest thing. I mean, after that, I got home and stuck my feet up.
That much in pain.
Yeah,
she sounds like the most wonderful thing to keep you going, and
definitely
hopefully you've got many more years to make memories and enjoy time with her, and you know you might even get to see her being a stroppy teenager.
I'm not looking forward to that, to be fair.
And you're being such a good role model for her and showing her how to embrace all aspects of life.
Yeah,
you know, teaching her so much that you probably don't even realize.
Yeah, and you know, chronic illness, whatever it is, can happen to anybody, so hopefully you know, in the future, if she's unfortunate enough to be one of those people, then she'll have the resilience and the tools in her toolbox ready to deal with it.
And thank you for sharing your story, because now hopefully other people can learn from your attitude and your approach and what you've said. So it's really, really invaluable. So thank you for
having me.
Thank you so much. It's been amazing.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Mortal and Strong podcast. If you want more information about today's voice, or how to get support on any of the issues we've discussed today, please head to our website, www.mortalandstrong.com. And remember, click subscribe, find us on all social media platforms, and to find out ways of how to support what we are doing or more information on the project, head to our website. Thank you for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.